That's the great Ray Charles at the keyboards with Moanin'. It's from his Genius and Soul Equal Jazz album with arrangements by Quincy Jones and Ralph Burns. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is, my goodness, the time flies so fast. It's Wednesday, April the 29th, 2015, and a surreal day in which the news media right now is, they're showing how we can all get along using Baltimore as a convenient backdrop. And in Baltimore, as we speak, the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra is playing the Star Spangled Banner and other classical music to one group of people in front of the Symphony Building. And in another part of Baltimore, there are people outside of a justice building demanding justice. Interestingly, the populations are completely different. An almost all white population gathered hearing symphony music, and another population, almost all black, clamoring for justice in this town that we're told is experiencing a crisis. And the word violence is all over the place. This is a town immersed in violence, coming out of violence, so much violence that, in fact, it is making history today, because for the first time in 145 years, the baseball games at Camden Yards will be played to an empty stadium. There will be no fans at the stadium tonight when the Baltimore Orioles face off against the Chicago White Sox. Violence, lots and lots of violence. Well, you know, I have a reference point about this kind of violence, and it goes to Brooklyn, as a matter of fact. And I want to tell you a story about a different kind of violence and how that violence was actually embraced and regarded and treated and resolved. It was 1978, I believe it was, 1978, when a local police officer at the 77th Precinct, a precinct based in the heart of Crown Heights, and Crown Heights was home then to a polyglot community, but was considered the seat of the Hasidic ultra-Orthodox sect of the Lubavitch, of Lubavitch Jews. Anyway, it was said that a police officer had detained a member of the Hasidic community on the Sabbath for questioning of some sort. And within minutes, hordes gathered at the precinct and escalated an attack and executed an attack on the precinct and all therein. They literally invaded the precinct and physically attacked all the officers and their superiors and anybody else that was found in the precinct. They physically attacked them. But they didn't stop there. They literally tore the precinct apart to the point that the precinct had to be rebuilt from scratch. That is to say, they destroyed the precinct, the police precinct. So let us review these few facts. On the basis of information that a member of their group had been detained and asked questions by a police officer who presumably was doing his job within his purview and his guidelines and his authority, they descended on the precinct. They physically assaulted several officers and their superiors who were in the precinct at the time. They ripped the entire precinct apart and caused it was beyond repair, caused the precinct to be rebuilt. So extensive was the damage to the police precinct. These are civilians attacking, physically attacking the police and destroying the police precinct. Well, what do you know? The mayor of the city of New York was outraged, but not at their behavior, and physically went down to the community, the Hasidic community, to apologize for the police officers' actions. The governor of the state of New York, similarly, was outraged, not at the lawlessness and the violence of the Hasidic community, but at the police officers' intemperate actions, and went to the community personally to apologize for the treatment and disregard of one of its members. The state comptroller was furious, but not at the community. He personally went to the community in order to comfort them and to sympathize with them and to apologize for the police officers' errant behavior and lack of judgment. Needless to say, first among those apologizing was the police commissioner himself. This was just outrageous. Not on the part of the civilians, but on the part of the police officer. So you see, there's violence, and then there's violence. Now, what would one consider an act of violence depends on the community, it appears, from which the actors come. We're hearing about all this violence going on in Baltimore, but we had many instances of this. By the way, there is a group of Orthodox Jews in Baltimore who, by local reports, have been doing their own policing, very often coming into conflict with the local police. They have their own patrols. They do their own policing. And they sometimes report the crimes that they are policing to the local police, and sometimes not. They've been accused of shielding criminals, as a matter of fact, from prosecution. But there has been no action taken. There's no violence being done there, according to official reports. They are of great assistance to the community, even though they are specific about the community that they patrol. We have those patrols still ongoing in Crown Heights and in almost all these other communities where they have their own private, separate community patrols, which have accounted for a great deal of violence. But I draw this to say, I draw this example to say that violence and the way it is being painted, you know, the word violence is being thrown around as if, my God, you know, there's a war going on. And we know that there isn't a war going on. Yes, we are clear. There have been fires set, most of them to cars and some to buildings. There's been some looting and there's been some rioting and so forth. But we should by now understand that this is not violence for violence's sake. We should have a far more complicated interpretation of what we're seeing in Baltimore by now to understand that this is not your routine violence. And we should therefore be very upset when the news media continue to paint this as a simplistic thing. It's a one-dimensional thing. And that comes out of the notion of what these communities represent to the powers that be. African-American communities, Latino communities, poor communities, for a long time now, are viewed across the board as essentially petri dishes full of bacteria. These are not communities with real human beings. These are petri dishes containing bacteria. And like bacteria, the challenge always is to keep them in check. Because, you know, bacteria, they will multiply and mutate, and next thing you know, they will escape the petri dish and infect perfectly good parts of society. But as long as they're contained in this petri dish, as long as the antibacterial measures are put into play and work predictably to contain the contagion, everything is fine. But when the bacteria becomes a little bit more virulent than they would like it to be, all hell is going to break loose, because the number one issue is to contain it. And after containing it, to get rid of it. Sometimes it doesn't follow that sequence. Sometimes you get rid of it as a way of containing it. But that's how these communities are seen. So let's take a look at how it was covered overnight by CNN and MSNBC. These are the so-called liberal bastions of journalism, and they took the typical 1960s approach to covering a very, very complex and long-standing problem. For one thing, just as in the 60s, the whites in the newsroom were too precious to send into the tumult of the South. So they left them on safe ground, and they sent in the blacks. You speak black, you go in there. You find out what your other blacks are thinking. And then you tell us, and then we tell the world. So they rounded up all their reliable blacks who didn't get very much play beyond these kinds of urban uprisings, and they put them into service. Go out there and you find out what your other black folks, because you talk black, that's a whole different language, and you could tell us what they are saying. And then we will distill that, and we will now form a panel discussion, and we will take it from there, because now we will take the information you gather, and we will now become very intellectual and authoritative about it. These are the liberals. These are the progressive folks covering a major story that has been popping up for centuries, and they still are operating well within the parameters of white supremacy. They still haven't gotten a clue, which is why, as we came to the air today, we have CNN basically presenting the palliative. Look, Baltimore is mending itself. There's symphony music downtown. And yes, there's the other protest on the other side, but of course they can't tell the story even as it's staring them in the face. Two entirely different populations with two entirely different focuses, two entirely different experiences in the same town, two entirely different treatments in the same town, and they can't spot it. Instead, they tell us the fact that the symphony orchestra is playing is proof of how Baltimoreans are dealing with the problem, unquote. So they send out their the black folks. You go into the community, you bring to the cameras the people that, you know, could tell us what is going on. Because, of course, when you talk to one black person, you might as well, you can say you have talked to the black world. Because all black people think alike, all black people have the same feelings, and so forth. And once we get that, you know, we will have fulfilled our mission to ascertain the mood of the community, and then we take it from there. Then we will call in our experts, and then we will be in charge of the reality that we are broadcasting. We'll tell the world what they're seeing. Most of the people covering this have never even been in Baltimore, not even as part of their regular news coverage. These are communities that don't even come to the attention of the news media unless something pathological is going down and their cameras can capture capture the flames, and the cameras can capture the misbehavior and the, quote, violence. But the rest of the year, they give us no understanding at all of what Baltimore is, how it came to be, what is happening there, how people are feeling about it, what is daily life like in that city, what are the issues that people are dealing with. They have absolutely no interest in communicating that to the outside world. But they're fighting when these things happen. They fight for the opportunity to say, I was there. Why? Because it looks good on their resumes. I covered Baltimore. I was there when it happened. I witnessed history. I witnessed the riots of Baltimore. It looks good, and they put another notch on their journalism belts to say, well, that proves that you're a good journalist. You were there. You were physically there. But how were you there? Let's take a look at how that happened. I was watching it. First of all, they are positioned exactly where they're told to stand. Everybody is milling around. All the camera people are in a designated journalism space. All these people who say they're anti-this and anti-that follow the rules of the police. They tell you, stand over there, and you and your cameras can only go so far, and they observe these rules implicitly. And what they're looking for is not the story. They're looking for film footage that puts them in the middle of the action. This is true. I'm not exaggerating here. They were hoping and praying that while they are there, quote, covering the story, unquote, something really disastrous would happen so that they would have the footage to show that they were in the thick of it, the intrepid reporters looking for the truth. And that's why they're there. They're covering, quote, unquote, covering this event, really hoping and praying. What has been going on, and that's why they keep calling it violence, what's going on is tame to what they want. They want open, a real, huge conflagration. And they're not getting it, so they're stoking it. The fact is, they want the story to erupt while they are there, because they have ignored the story all along while they were not there. They were not there when the story had been happening all these years. And this is true all throughout America. These are communities that have been written off by the media and that are looked at, again, as petri dishes full of bacteria. There's misery, there's crime, there's murder, there's poverty, and all of that. And besides which, these are not real people. They're not the ones to articulate their own issues because they're not that smart. They're not cognizant of their own realities. And on Sunday morning, they go and hunt down the people with degrees. The black bourgeois, those are the ones who might know something. And they tell us what the system is telling us. We had the phenomenon not too long ago of Marc Morial, the president of the National Urban League, bringing us the breaking story. The urgent story that the black community is in crisis. Wow. This is breaking news. And it is the story, as I said then, that has been told for 39 consecutive years. But the reporters would pretend And they hadn't heard that, that they don't know this. And they all are going to pretend that this is news. The community is in crisis. And they will tell the story not from the point of view that something ought to be done about it. And they can use their skill and their resources and their capabilities and their capacities to solve problems, to influence change, to do just that, to create change. They will report it simply as a way of affirming to the system that their methods and modalities of control remain effective. So we have now a conjoining of effort. The people who are supposed to be fighting for these beleaguered constituencies and communities are at one with the system that is doing them in. And there is such a distance between them and the people who are looking to them to advocate in their interests that it is appalling. We have people like Eric Holder talking about how, you know, this is a stunning report that Ferguson remains essentially a plantation city. How stunning! Well, what kind of life are you living as a leader that this is news to you? That the reality of our existence in many, many parts of this country is unchanged from the 1700s and 1600s. This violence that is occurring. I talked yesterday about the demand that as these communities suffer oppression, just unrelenting, unstoppable oppression, they are required also to behave. Just shut up and deal with it. Accept it. This is what we have to do to keep you in check. Accept it. And when you react, they double up. Well, you will behave because now you are under martial law. You were technically under martial law all along because the police can shoot you at any time. They could kill you at any time. There's enough evidence to support the argument that they're comfortable enough to feel that they need not think twice about these actions, because if they commit such a heinous act, more than likely they'll get away with it. And the community as a community will not be permitted to respond the way the Hasidic community in Crown Heights was allowed to respond, in fact, encouraged to respond and apologized to for the fact that the police officer was actually doing his job. So, when is violence violence? It depends on which community is expressing the so-called violence. And it depends on what this violence is. As awful as things have looked on camera, we can see that there have been no deaths in Baltimore. The damage has been to property. And still we come back to that notion, and it is an old historical notion as it applies to African Americans, that your life is less than the value of property. Property is more important than your life. That has been a known maxim as it applies to African Americans. Because African Americans, too, are property. It is appalling that as this unfolds, and we have had so many precedents leading up to the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, we've had so many instances and so many repeats of the cycle. It is appalling that we still get the same predictable responses by the state, by the apparatus of government, by organizations that say they are advocates, by leadership that is supposed to look to the aggregate good of the community. We still get the same old answers, the same predictable responses. And we are told by the media, a compliant press, that has even less energy now for really doing good work. They are merchandisers of information. And news is about being first. It's about winning prizes. It's about being a notch on your resume that you were physically there. It has nothing to do with the fact that your work is connected to beneficial change, that you are unearthing facts that are useful, that would change the course of a horrible history. It is all about merchandising for private gain, for notoriety, for awards, for an increase in pay, for a byline in a revered medium or news outlet, for your 15 seconds of fame. And we're seeing all of this play out in Baltimore. All of it is playing out all over again, which is why, you know, there's nothing new. There's nothing new here to report. There may be different aspects, but there's nothing really new. The structural problem remains remarkably intact and untouched. The power arrangements, the power equation remains remarkably intact. It is the same story. We've been talking about this story for centuries. It is codified in the law, including in the Supreme Court. The black man has no rights that the white man is bound to respect. This is not a new story. But we are encouraged to believe that there's something really different here this time. And it's about the violence. They can capture the violence of it without talking about the history of it, without talking about the structure of oppression, without talking about the omnipresence all over the country. This is the story. All over the country, the story also is the pathetic response by media, by the apparatus of government, by the elected leadership, and even by people who positioned themselves as leaders. No one really is removing the barriers. No one is doing the hard, unglamorous, unsexy, dirty work of confronting the problems. It is hard. It is very unsexy. You got to roll up your sleeves. You got to get into the dirt. You have to alienate people who you might be looking for money from. It is not about, your high position anymore. You are in the trenches. This is trench warfare. And in an age where everybody's looking for the fast way, the quick buck, you will find very few people who will want to stand up firm and resolute, really in the interest of justice. They have no interest in that. But they will take a lot of time to convince us, to create an alternate reality, to tell us the reality we know really isn't what the situation is. It is something else. And now we are told that the issue now is Freddie Gray. And yes, it's Freddie Gray. But I said to you some time ago, just a couple of weeks ago, we had 400 Freddie Grays in Philadelphia alone. So is it about Freddie Gray? Or is it about all of these Freddie Grays that we have allowed to be killed and with absolutely nothing done to change the systemic attitudes or the power equation? I'll stop here for now, and we'll take a break and come back to your thoughts. But I want you, I'm concentrating on how these things are being fashioned and retooled to play psychological games. The problem hasn't changed at all. This is not a new story. And we should not fall for this story that they're telling us, that this is something entirely new, that requires entirely new approaches and all this kind of nonsense. No, it's the same thing. It's a story we know very, very well. But we also ought to have the courage to admit that so many things are failing us, and yet we continue to keep faith with them. We'll be back right after this short break. Listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. The number to call is 888-874-4888. We're talking about Baltimore. Now that there's all this new information to learn, but looking at how the developments are being treated so as to give us an impression that there's something brand new going on here, but we see a loose conspiracy of interest to give us false information about a reality we know very, very well. 888-874-4888. As you look at the news, as you look at the coverage, as you look at the reports that we're getting, not only from the news media, but also from the so-called leadership, what are your impressions? What's going on? How do we move basically into this current situation? How do we move into it? And how do we move outside of it? That's the question I'm asking you today. 888-874-4888. And while the calls are coming in, let me just say another word of thanks. I mean, the responses I've gotten to the program on Monday have been just extraordinary. I'm inundated. I can't keep up. But I want to thank you so much for your good, good thoughts and your prayers and your good wishes. And I will lean on them as I go forward in the future. So thank you so very much for your wonderful words. I'll try and get back to you personally, which is what I like to do when people write me, take the time to write me. So thank you so much for that. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Let's see, is anyone on the air yet? Not yet. Okay. Well, I want you to take special care to observe how this is unfolding, because this is a lesson. And we have seen this lesson play out, as I said, in other cities before. We discussed Detroit, and we did that in infinite detail, because it is exactly the same story. You can just switch out one city for another, and that's what you will find. Exactly the same scenario with a few, minor details that are different. But essentially, this is the same story. We know the story by heart now. We talked about it in Chicago. We've talked about it in Washington, D.C. We've talked about it in New York City. It's the same story. It is not a Baltimore story. That's the first thing. It is a universal story for African Americans, Latinos in particular. So don't be fooled by this idea that, you know, they localize it and therefore, you know, you can just, if it's solved in Baltimore, then the situation is solved. It's not. It's not like that at all. It's a systemic problem being shaped to fulfill our notions, simplistic ideas that they think that we have, that it's all about Baltimore and it's all about this particular case. It isn't. But in any event, it is important that we certainly pay attention to the specific case of Freddie Gray, because it is an atrocity, and we should proceed with the case of Freddie Gray, but within the context of all of the Freddie Grays, the hundreds of Freddie Grays that we have lost. Vincent, you're on the air.
Thank you. First of all, I would like to say I'm supporting you, and I'm thinking about you in regards to your health. Stay strong.
Thank you. One thing
I want to focus on is that I saw video footage down in Maryland where supposedly a young mother was disciplining her son who was taking up a stance in a resistance against the police oppression and occupation and under that martial law. It's sad to see a black woman who can just openly physically abuse her supposedly son and not be brought to task on that when he's standing up for what's going on in his neighborhood. We saw some weeks ago of a black woman being beaten and brutalized to the side of a road out in California by law enforcement. We saw on TV of a black woman driving up to the White House in a vehicle with no threatening moves being shot and killed by law enforcement. So when black youth see this and see no black men standing up, what are they to do? They can't just lay down on the ground when they see where a black woman might be abused and he's standing up being abused allegedly by his own mother who should be standing up with him, with their father if possible. Thank you.
Well, let me ask you a question, Vincent.
Yes, ma'am.
That particular film grab, that particular piece of film has been repeatedly played over and over and over. What do you think is the reason for that?
Well, I think it's a propaganda technique to mislead those who are watching just that particular station that they might see, or that footage continuously being played around over and over to give a certain perspective and the thoughts of those who are viewing it without any alternative media on the ground that they can tune into, you know, over the air or some type of network on the internet. Or just calling someone they might know down in Maryland and say, hey, what's going on in your backyard?
What does it say? What do you think the statement is being made? An implicit statement. They're showing this clip repeatedly. What do you think the statement is about black family life And the tacit permission, if not downright outright approval, that this mother has gotten, she's been on talk shows and so forth, that she has gotten by being violent, because supposedly this thing is about people being concerned about the violence being done in Baltimore, and here we have a mother being quite violent with her child. What do you think is the meaning behind it?
It can send mixed messages. One of them is that it's all right for us to abuse ourselves and our own family, but when someone outside of our family abuses us, disrespects us, that's okay. But when we try to stand up against the abuse from those on the outside of the family, we don't get as much support and coverage that we should. And when it's inside the family, we don't know how to deal with it properly at this state, this point in our lives, to show that on the outside, hey, this is how we can deal with it without being violent on the inside of the family, but we can deal with the issues of the violence on the outside. We need to talk about both things, and sometimes we need to have these discussions among ourselves without outside interference.
I agree, but it also, you know what, it occurred to me that what they were saying is, hey, folks, this is how they're accustomed to behaving. You know, this is what they're used to. And the violence between the mother and her son is the same kind of violence that they're now exporting to the rest of Baltimore. This is how they behave. This is what they do. So this is kind of a genetic marker for African Americans. This is the model type of behavior that they're exposed to.
That could be part of one way of looking at it. And we need to see more black men standing up saying, hey, this might not be my son or this might not be my nephew, but I stand with this youth, and we can show a different tactic on the outside for the family as well as in the inside.
Well, thank you very much, Vincent, for your call today. Very, very solid thoughts to ponder here. Thank you for contributing. From New York also, Jay, you're on the air.
Patrice, how are you? I hope that you are doing well. My prayers are for you.
Thank you.
That the ancestors will definitely protect you and guide you through this, and you will come out all right. I would like to just say the main thing is the diet. But
thank you so much. What are your thoughts about Baltimore?
I think it's basically a game in the part of the media to show or make it seem as though they care about what's going on, but they won't deal with the reasons why these things are happening. They are skating around and making excuses and showing things like the woman that smacked her son as a form of, this is what they respond to, this subjective or threat of violence, and then when there is violence, then they get in line. But they just don't want to deal at all on why are the cops not being prosecuted in the manner that they should be for what they did to the young man. I mean, you know, I'm just waiting for, I think it's Friday, when the report will come out in regards to what supposedly happened. And, you know, then we'll see how the community responds. But I think that mostly they're looking for the community to respond in a negative way. And if we really look and observe at what's happening, I don't think the community is really responding in a negative way. I think that there are people out there who are trying to get the community to come together, you know, with the whole narrative, with the Bloods and the Crips, to get them to form some kind of truce so that they will work together to better the community. It seems to me that the media has more of a problem with the young people coming together and forming a truce and an alliance with one another than anything. I think they prefer for them to be at odds with one another them to unite with one another.
Well, thank you for your contribution today. I think you made a couple of very solid points. We'll see how people react. And the idea is, one of the points that you made, this is nothing new. This really isn't new. But we are anticipating a report that is supposed to be available on Friday. They're supposed to be releasing a report on the specifics of the death of Freddie Gray on Friday. We wouldn't know, we really don't know what will be contained in this report. But report or no report, the issue is that it still will pertain to this one specific case when we are clear that even in Baltimore, Freddie Gray's case is not just a singular case. It is a systemic problem. So we'll see what happens on Friday, but we already have enough information to discuss how this entire situation is being responded to and why. What is the vested interest by the various parties in controlling what we know about this case and controlling our attitudes and behaviors toward it? So thanks so much for your call today. Well, that brings us to the end of the program, and I just wanted to raise these questions so that you begin to think about them. And you begin to talk about it, because what has hampered us a lot is that we don't spend enough time disassembling things and looking at each component part. The other side is doing that every single day, every minute of the day. They're organized in their effort, their campaign of nullification, getting us to think that the reality that we know isn't really the reality at all, that the reality is something else, and they fashion it for us, and they hand it to us, and they tell us, this is the reality. This is how you're supposed to react, and you may react now. These are systems of control. It is time for us to be able to disassemble the component parts, and we can see that when we do that, we are not encountering any new scenarios. These scenarios go back to the 1600s. This is nothing new in our historical experience, even if they insist that that is the case. And therefore, we should be about the business of constructing entirely different responses, because our responses also have become quite predictable. So the power equation has not changed. They are in charge of pulling the chain, and then we react to the chain being pulled. It's got to be a whole different formula, and we ought to be about the business of constructing entirely different formulas. Why? Because this is a systemic problem. It is not located strictly in Ferguson, Missouri, or in Staten Island, or in Baltimore. It is all over America, and you can just pretty much substitute one name of one city for another, and it's the same thing. It's the same story. So the time has come, long since past, I would contend, that we ought to be thinking of different ways of doing things. We ought to be thinking of different ways of exercising our economic and political and social power. We ought to be thinking very carefully about who we entrust with the privilege of leadership, who we designate as our ambassadors, who holds sway in the formulation of policy that ends up affecting our everyday lives. These are the discussions we ought to be having. And we see that, again, using Detroit as the template, we see what is in store. The systematic emptying of these cities, causing people all kinds of grief in the interim and in the transition of moving them out. Just ethnic cleansing is going on. It is taking different shapes, and one of the shapes is death by police. It's as simple as that.
when you have in one city alone more than 400 people being killed by police in the course of just a few years, you can't call it anything but a crisis. Thank you so much for joining me today. I always think of it as a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.